Welcome back, everybody, to a brand new episode of the Space Show Show. I am your host, Lieutenant Commander Rebecca Frost, joined by Admiral Kerry Jackson and Commander Robert Neal and Commodore Worstly Cruncher.
Yep.
He first popped up, and I thought it said Worcestershire Cruncher.
Yeah.
So I'm just going to call him Commodore Worcestershire. We are embarking on a brand new mission, a very exciting mission. We are embarking on season three of...
Yay!
I just kicked my cat, everybody. We're embarking on season three of Star Trek The Next Generation. We will be talking about these episodes, Evolution, The Ensigns of Command, The Survivors, Who Watches the Watchers, and The Bonding. Now... everybody got me like real hyped for season three because everyone's like, once you get to season three, it's wind in your sails. It's so much better.
Well, because there's gabardine in the uniforms now.
Gabardine makes everything better.
Yeah.
We got a lot of new stuff, right?
Yeah.
We got a brand new intro. We have new outfits. The outfits are now two pieces instead of one piece. So you don't have, there was concern about the bones of people for these outfits. I'll talk about those later on.
And the reproductive organs of one person in particular.
There's new jobs. Some people have new jobs. Geordi got a promotion to Lieutenant Commander, and Worf got a promotion to Lieutenant. So let's see how they fit into these new roles and these new outfits in this first episode, Evolution. Wesley's latest science project escapes the lab, threatening the Enterprise and an eminent scientist's lifelong project. The Big Hero 6 episode of Star Trek The Next Generation.
Nicely put.
This episode has a fun guest star in Ken Jenkins. You might know him as Bob Kelso from Scrubs.
He's a genius.
He's an absolute genius. So the Enterprise brings along eminent scientist Dr. Paul Stubbs to the site of a binary star system, which is expecting a massive stellar explosion that occurs once every 196 years. And Dr. Paul has waited many years for this event and has devoted his entire life to its study. The Enterprise, however, begins suffering a series of malfunctions. It destabilizes for a few minutes, leading the ship into the path of star matter from the red giant to the neutron star, which causes a problem for Dr. Paul Stubbs because that's what he's here for. And it will not allow the Enterprise to launch his probe into the red giant as intended. However, there will be another opportunity. The food
in
150
years.
Yeah, it'll be fine. Just, I'm sure, what's the lifespan? What's the life expectancy in the year 23? Who'sie, what'sie?
Oh, not how quite old was that long. How old was McCoy when he showed up on the first episode?
137.
Yeah, 137.
Decrepit.
And wow. In Picard season one, they were saying that he would live to be a healthy nonagenarian.
Oh.
Oh, my God.
With the upgrades that he was given.
So the Enterprise isn't working. Food slots aren't working properly. Sensors indicate the approach of a Borg vessel. The ship's computers are not able to determine the cause of these malfunctions because, according to the computer, there were no malfunctions. So
everything's fine, just fine.
And of course, Wesley Crusher is the root of it all. He was running a nano experiment, right? Where he took some nanobots from, where was it?
Sickbay, I believe.
Sickbay, because they were working on using these nanobots to heal humans. And so Wesley was like, oh, I bet I could do something with this. Anyway, Dr. Kelso is very upset that he might not be able to launch his probe. Geordi analyzes the ship's circuits under a microscope and finds them disintegrating at a rapid rate. He suspects that something is eating the circuits alive, and Wesley does a big rut-row, goes to his room, and finds that his experiment of nanobots has escaped. He confides in Guinan that he took two nanites from sickbay, which were designed to repair human cells, because he wanted to see how they work in pairs, but they escaped. The next
he left the lid off the jar.
Basically, yeah.
The jar is sitting there on his desk. And he's like, oh, how'd they get out?
Which is so funny because...
You got force fields? Come on.
In the season two real finale, where he leaves, air quotes, his experiment running on the Enterprise, he seems pretty knowledgeable and cautious about that. But it's okay. Later, we're going to talk a little bit more about where Wesley's head is at, because Wesley's feeling a little stretched thin.
This is how you get peanut hamper.
Do you want peanut hamper? This is how you get peanut hamper. The next launch window for this probe arrives, but the shuttle bay's doors fail to open, and they still cannot launch the probe. Wesley confides in Beverly, who is back on the Enterprise, baby.
No explanation or anything.
Nothing. Just, I'm back. Here we are. Let's just forget that happened.
I did a year at Starfleet Medical. I did a year. Yeah. That was enough. Mm-hmm. It's on the resume.
She was concerned about her presence limiting Wesley's development, but she's back, I guess. She confides to Picard, and Picard asks Beverly to give Wesley more time to adjust to her presence on the ship, because Wesley is also like, ooh, now that my mom's back, I gotta reconcile this chief medical officer versus my mommy, you know? Like, yeah. Where is the balance there?
But then he also says, Mom, I think I screwed up.
Mommy.
My monster has come back to kill me.
Mommy, my nanobites are disintegrating all of the Enterprise computer circuits. And not only are these nanites eating the computer circuits, but they are replicating themselves, accelerating the attacks on the ship. So Picard assigns Data to work with Wesley to remove the nanites, and Stubbs wants them eradicated immediately. Because he fears that the nanites will prevent him from completing his experiments, which, of course, he has spent his whole life working on. So I can kind of understand where he's coming from. Stubbs decides to take the matter into his own hands, making it much worse. He throws high gamma bursts at the main circuits to destroy the nanites. The nanites in that core die, but other nanites see this as an attack on their, air quotes, colony, and attack the Enterprise more ferociously by stopping the life support systems. And the nanites thus prove that they have evolved and are now a life form. So I love Star Trek because we're just casually making AIs. We're just casually making new life forms.
Yeah.
And there's just the...
To seek out and create new life forms. That wasn't in the thing. No.
To boldly create.
This episode was a few years before the AI scare hit Hollywood. You know, before you had garbage like Lawnmower Man and...
Yeah, that's true.
What was it? Sandra Bullock in The Net. Oh, don't forget
that.
But
you did have Terminator already. So we did have the beginnings of the scare, because Terminator was like 5 years before this.
Yeah, oh, geez, probably even so. Yeah. Hmm. But robot scared.
So the nanites attack Stubbs, Dr. Kelso, in his cabin, and... Picard asks Data to figure out a way to communicate with the nanites, but Data volunteers to have a few of the nanites enter his body and take control of his voice functions to communicate with the bridge.
That wasn't a risk at all.
No, that's just, we have the one android. It'll be fine, I'm sure. Yeah. The nanites say that they need raw materials to replicate, and Picard explains to them that they've endangered the ship with their actions, and both apologize to each other. Which...
It's like, but you're attacking us. Well, you're attacking us.
You got your peanut butter in my chocolate. You got your chocolate in my peanut butter. Dr. Kelso uses his connections at Starfleet to designate the planet Cavus Alpha 5 as the new home for the nanite civilization, as they have evolved beyond the need of human assistance. They reconstruct the computer core of the Enterprise and leave the ship. End Ta-da. Of story. No but- consequences.
But here's the thing that bothered me most about this episode. Wesley, oops, look what I did. And then he's not there to help fix the problem. He's off chasing girls.
Mm-hmm.
He just, it's like, okay, here's something bad that I did. You guys fix it. I'll be over here talking to girls.
I have one word for you. Teenager.
Yeah.
I read a couple interviews with him and with Marina Sirtis talking about their problems that the writers had with their characters. Like, they could use them as a foil for something, but once they set it up, they just didn't know where to go with it. Like, oh, exactly. What do we do with this psychic? What do we do with this teenager? Well, the problem. But
it really sucks because once they gave Wesley responsibility, my respect for him grew 8 times that day, yeah. Right? Like, he has responsibility and he can create problems. Give him an opportunity to solve a problem. Some bits of trivia. Let's talk about the new uniform. It's a 2-piece uniform replacing the 1-piece jumpsuit design. And the entire cast vastly preferred the 2-piece design over the previous costumes because they were much more comfortable.
I mean, I didn't have to try one on to know that. You just looked at it,
baby.
And more importantly, easier to deal with when going to the restroom. Additionally, several cast members found the old uniform so tight and restrictive, there was legitimate concern that the old uniforms would cause permanent bone and joint damage over time due to how they were forced to walk and sit while wearing them. A Star Trek video floating around that Rob shared with us was Marina Sirtis taking us on a tour through the Star Trek costuming department, where to be on Star Trek is to be uncomfortable. And all of the costumes required to be on Star Trek are just insanely uncomfortable. Guinan mentions that she has many children and has had many husbands, and I demand more Guinan lore immediately.
Yeah.
This is a great setup for her. And then this one's just for me. Scott Grimes, who, if you may know, he's the dad on Ted, voices Steve on American Dad, works with Seth MacFarlane on a lot of his projects. Scott Grimes has a minor uncredited role as one of Wesley Crusher's friends. And there's a deleted scene where he's featured pretty prominently in some like holodeck workout gear. And apparently Scott Grimes is like really good friends with Will Wheaton and also Chris Hardwick. And I would hate to be in a room with the three of them at the same time.
Sounds like a lot of nerd musk.
A lot of nerd musk. But that one was just for me, a big Scott Grimes fan myself.
Here's the thing. Another thing about this episode is that I didn't know anything about nanotech until this episode.
Yep.
I learned all about it.
Why would you, right?
Exactly. Well, I'm a DJ, for Christ's sake, you know.
Well, I don't think most people out of theoretical applied sciences knew much about nanotechnology
exactly.
at this point.
So I learned a lot about nanotech. And then the second thing is that the nanites became characters on Mystery Science Theater 3000 during the Sci-Fi Channel days. They created their own little puppet versions of nanites that were all throughout the Satellite of Love, yeah.
So where season 3 does an interesting thing for me, and that you start seeing it in this episode, and you really start seeing it about midway through the season, is Michael Piller took over as showrunner for Next Gen. And what he did, and he's credited for literally revolutionizing the way Next Gen and DS9 after ended up working, is he opened up the submission process for non-represented writers. So a writer could send in a script and Piller would greenlight it, even if they didn't have an agent, even if they weren't represented, and develop them as writers. And that's how we get Ronald Moore. Ronald Moore is literally a byproduct. He's on a tour of the Next Gen set and says, hey, I've got an idea. And Piller's like, say more. And that's how you get these writers. And you especially see it when episode 15, Yesterday's Enterprise, hits. It was an episode that was pitched by an uncredited writer, an underrepresented writer, and then it went through several different iterations and then hit Ronald Moore, who did the polish on it. And it's literally people who would have never been given a chance in the old writer's room under Piller saying, let's see what you got, let's see what you can do. And because of that, we get some real audacious Trek.
Mm-hmm. Man, wouldn't that be nice?
Yeah.
Wouldn't that be nice to still do that? I mean, I'm sure there are still some shows out there that do this, but moving on to the Ensigns of Command. After 101 How do numbers work, you guys? After 111 years of silence, an extremely litigious alien race asserts its agreed-upon right to wipe out a Federation colony in its territory. If they're extremely litigious, why didn't they do something about this previously?
Get a treaty.
So after a century of silence, the Enterprise receives a message from the Shalia system, informing them that they have discovered a human colony on a world in their sector on the fifth planet of the Tau Cygnus system. As they will be colonizing the planet themselves in 4 days' time, they want the Enterprise to evacuate all humans from their territory. The planet in question is a high radiation zone, and no one can understand how any human could be living there. As the ship gets there, due to radiation, the transporters are ineffective, and so are all the weapons. The Shalia consider humans a lower life form and will eradicate them if their wishes are not complied with. So of course, what do we do when there's when humans cannot survive? We send our friend Data. And so this is Data's big day out. So Data is sent to the planet on a shuttle.
In a little tiny shuttle. Little tiny.
To arrange for everyone.
Tiniest shuttle ever.
I know, right? It's like the Ford Pinto of all the shuttles.
But they fixed the door.
They did.
Very important.
And I think it was on a Ford Festiva chassis.
Probably.
The settlers were originally on a ship Artemis that was lost a few centuries ago and was massively off course. And once there, however, he finds a population of over 15,000 people who have firmly have no intention of leaving, as they have been on the planet for 90 years. The Shaliak have given 3 days to evacuate the planet, even with all the shuttles, but it will take 4 weeks for evacuation to be completed. A colonist leader, Goshevin, tells Data how a third of the original settlers were killed before they adapted to the radiation, but they are firm there will be no evacuation. While Picard seeks a way to get more time from the Shaliak, as they are completely uninterested in talking or negotiating, Data enlists the help of one local Mackenzie to convince the rest to leave. I saw this conversation happen when it came to Dune as well, that how funny that the names Jessica and Paul are in the future. And here we are in 23 whatever, when we're talking to someone named Adrian Mackenzie. Must have...
At least it's a last name and not like
must have Utah ancestors. excuse me. She is fascinated by the android and spends more time with Data to learn how he functions. Picard orders Geordi to find a way to make the transporters work. I love this scene because Picard is talking to Geordi and O'Brien and he's like, "We got to make this work." And both Geordi and O'Brien are like, "There's no way." And Picard's like, "Figure it out." And leaves. And instead of them going, "Oh, geez," like they're like, "Okay." And they set right to it. It's the there's something about the Star Trek work ethic that I really respect.
That's Starfleet. That's
mm-hmm. I guess we better Montgomery Scott it.
Yep.
Yes. We better figure it out. While they are working on that, because also Starfleet cannot get ships there for another 3 weeks. Insane. Anyway, Picard decides to intercept the Shaliak ship while it's en route to the planet in order to buy more time for Data. Meanwhile, Data, his presence has caused fear amongst the colonists, and who can blame them? This random robot man has come to their planet and tells them that they have to leave? Seems suspicious. So Goshevin calls for a public meeting. Mackenzie asks Data to use reverse psychology in addition to facts in order to get his point across, but he fails, of course.
Of course.
As one, he is a robot.
He's not going to figure this out.
And two, the crowd is unwilling to confront their leader, Goshevin, and he convinces the colonists to make a stand against the Shaliak for their sweat and blood. You guys, there's no way. I appreciate the hustle and the ambition, but there's no way. Data conducts a separate meeting of like-minded people, and Goshevin cattle prods Data to shut him down, and so Data is knocked out of commission. Meanwhile, back on the Enterprise, Deanna is prepping Picard for his confrontation with the Shaliak. She asks Picard to be precise as they find human language confusing.
Yes.
Which is something I try to, it's something I try to do in my day-to-day interactions anyway, yep. Right? Like if I'm asking my husband for a glass of water, I'll say, can I have a glass of water right now? You know, like you have to be super specific. And can you put it on the desk? You know?
My wife needs to watch this episode, clearly.
They intercept the ship and ask for a face-to-face as per the tenets of the treaty. This is granted. Deanna and Picard beam over to the ship, and the Shaliak still insists that the given time has elapsed, and if Picard can't remove them, they will be eradicated. Deanna and Picard are beamed back to the Enterprise, and Data fixes himself and awakens. He modifies a laser to work and destroys the aqueduct, providing water to the colony.
Now, since the Roman Empire, there has never been a more important aqueduct ever in stories.
If you won't leave, I'll make you leave.
My
destroys your
father's
crucial.
Blood is on that mountain. My grandfather's blood is on that mountain.
Burn and salt the ground on which your crops are grown.
And if this wasn't Star Trek, I'd be playing a douchey Ski Academy adversary in some Showtime movie.
But he even says, if one android with a phaser can do this much damage, imagine what the Shaliak can do.
Yeah, and dummy.
I can't.
They're going to blow up all the aqueducts.
Fathom not getting this point across earlier. Anyway, so they agree. Picard reads the treaty with the Shaliak and evokes an arbitration clause, and the Shaliak agrees, but Picard chooses the Grizzales as arbiters, who are known to have a long hibernation period and will only awaken in 6 months. The Shaliak give Picard his 3 weeks. The evacuation is successful. McKenzie kisses Data goodbye.
You won this round, Picard, with your negotiating.
I personally love negotiation plot lines in Star Trek. when one is so stubborn and you just know one is right. Yeah. The shuttle Onizuka, which Data rode in, was named in tribute to astronaut Ellison Onizuka, who was killed in the Space Shuttle Challenger in 1986.
Oh. Well, there you go.
The Shaliak costume is the same costume used for the alien Armus in Skin of Evil, only this time not covered in oil.
Mm-hmm.
During filming, this is so fascinating to me. The entourage of the Dalai Lama visited the sets and had pictures taken with Brent Spiner. O'Brien plays cello on the screen and is never seen again.
Yeah. And I don't think it ever comes up that he can play the cello again.
I don't think Keiko likes the cello.
It is it's discussed by characters later, but never seen again.
Yeah.
All in all, kind of a forgettable episode, in my opinion.
I think there's one notable thing. I think this is the first time the new Space Village set is shown outside. I think, because in this episode, it's got steps that pour water, but then you're going to see an episode in 2 seasons with Ensign Ro where they're actual steps. And it's like this all-purpose space colony set that they just move buildings around in a little bit. It's not quite the Planet Hell set where they're like, hey, we've got this thing made of concrete. But I think it's the first time they used it, because you will see this set, this outdoor space colony set, about 30,000 more times during the run of this series.
Mm. Well, I mean, you're just going to drop ship about orbit, aren't you?
Well, yeah, and it makes sense if you think about it from a prefabricated standpoint, as you would just drop prefabs, especially for colonists. But when I was 19, I was too edgy to like it.
One last thing about this episode. According to Paramount's public records, actor Granger Hines, who played Goshavin, was unhappy with his performance, so he requested his name be removed from the credits. All of his lines were subsequently overdubbed by another actor.
Yes!
Which I noticed. I was like, this has worse dubbing than Madam Web. Maybe it was the timing.
And see, I was thinking it was because of the water on the set running that they had to go back and revoice, because the mic also picked up the sound of the running water. But no, that makes more sense now.
Okay,
theorists, however, find several holes in this idea, and many fans believe it to be a cover story for a secret incident which Paramount did not want publicized.
This is a guy who in 1974 starred in Summer School Teachers, and he was worried about his performance.
You clearly never met my high school drama teacher.
Yeah, he was in 1993 Street Night. Do you remember Street Night, Carrie? It was one of those USA Network.
I'd have to go back in my memory file, and I may have pushed it out. I don't know.
Yeah, yeah.
I only quickly want to talk about this next episode, The Survivors. The Enterprise responds to a distress call from Reyna 4, a Federation colony that is under attack from an unknown alien ship. When they arrive, they find the entire surface of the planet destroyed, save for a single house and two occupants. This episode is crazy because they find this planet, and they see the planet is totally destroyed except for one plot of land, right? And so they beam down. The away team is led by Riker, Geordi, Beverly, Worf, and Data. Huge away team for this, but what do I know? And they find two people, an old couple named Kevin. And Rashawn. They have been on the colony for 5 years but married for 53. Kevin talks about a large ship that appeared a few weeks ago and took their world apart. They refuse to leave with the away team to the Enterprise. While they are there in the house, they open this music box, and the horrific music that emits from it haunts Deanna in her mind 24/7, and it drives her insane. Deanna, she admits to Picard that she finds Kevin and Rashawn elusive and that their music is haunting her. And while Lieutenant Worf is known for his reputation of thoroughness, it suddenly appears that there is a huge ship appearing that's like 5 times larger than the Enterprise. The ship fires a beam at the Enterprise and does little damage. Picard fires phasers at it and the ship takes off. The ship Enterprise pursues. They come to the conclusion that this ship appeared to be a lure away from the planet. So they return to the planet where Rashawn is like, oh, okay, welcome. Whereas Kevin is ever so cold to
go away.
Friends.
We don't want you here.
Why are you back? Did we say no thank you?
Picard's like, I would love to gift you this replicator. And Kevin is like, no thank you. We learn that Kevin chose not to fight when their planet was attacked, and this was the only thing that he and Rashawn did differently from the rest, and that's why they seem to have survived. Meanwhile, Deanna is in extreme pain from this horrendous music, and Beverly has no idea what to do to help her. The big starship returns and knocks their shields out. The Enterprise's phasers and torpedoes have no effect. Picard retreats from the planet, and the starship doesn't pursue them. An hour later, the Enterprise returns back to the planet, and what they determine is that the starship is responding to Kevin and Rashawn's wishes, trying to scare them away from the planet. So Picard returns again to Kevin and Rashawn, tells them about Deanna, and talks about how the Enterprise was attacked. And he asks, you know, if you guys don't want to board the Enterprise, we're going to stay in orbit for... we're gonna stay in orbit while you guys are still alive. And again, the starship attacks, but this time destroying the house that they are in, air quotes, killing them. And so now the Enterprise has no reason to stay. But they stay in orbit. 3 hours later, the house reappears. So Picard beams down. What's going on, kids? And
I just love how the away team just walks in the house. They don't knock or
not
ring
even
the doorbell.
Knock.
Just
not oh, even
Picard's,
a knock.
Picard's like, did I interrupt a waltz?
Hello.
So Picard guesses correctly that Rashawn is not real. She is just a recreation, just like the house is. Kevin is the only living creature on the planet, and he is not human. He changes into his true form and a form of energy and cures Deanna and makes the music go away, which he was using as kind of like a security thing to help them leave. He admits that he's been living as a human for 50 years and he is a Daud, an immortal being. He has been in this galaxy for thousands of years and 50 years ago fell in love with Rashawn. They settled on the colony for their retirement, but it was attacked by the Huznok, a hideous intelligence. He did not kill them, as it is his way of life not to kill, but Rashawn died, and in that instance of grief, his hatred exploded like the Scarlet Witch, and he destroyed the Huznok, not just the ships, but the entire civilization of 50 billion people. Show over. Not a nary a consequence to be seen for anybody.
No, he had to live with...
Well, I mean, Picard was like, stay away from this planet. We're done here. I mean, he was just like, yeah, we're not going to mess with this. We already got Q to deal with. I don't need another issue with somebody like that. We're good.
He killed the daddy sand people and the mommy sand people and the baby sand people.
That's right.
Yeah.
So, Rebecca, did you see the trivia on this one about the actor who played Kevin?
About how his wife had recently died while they were working on the episode?
And he almost didn't take it because of that. Yeah.
Wow.
He later described his role in this episode as one of the hardest he ever had to play. And
he was on Bonanza.
This is also very important. The first appearance of Troy's teal uniform with the skirt.
Which I like.
Lovely,
yes.
Was that, you guys?
I think she probably appreciated it too, because it didn't look quite as binding as some of the other uniforms they put her in. So, because they were talking about how they just cinched her into those costumes and
wow.
You know, yeah.
Let's talk about my favorite episode of the bunch. Who watches the Watchers? A proto-Vulcan culture worships Captain Picard and prepares to offer Counselor Troy as a sacrifice. This one is full of Renfair Vulcans, you guys.
and Ray Wise.
And Ray Wise. Wise is there.
And Bobby Hill.
And Bobby Hill. Oh my God.
Pamela Adlon. Pamela Adlon is the little girl.
That's my purse. I don't know you.
But she was Pamela Siegel at the time. It was okay. She wasn't Pamela Adlon. But she is the voice of Bobby Hill. And she also has a wonderful show on FX called Better Things that you should watch. It's very good.
Okay.
So the Enterprise is to provide technical assistance to an anthropological field team on the planet Mintaka 3, which is observing, in hiding, the Vulcanoid Bronze Age native population. Their holographic hiding place is ravaged by an explosion. The landing party and its advanced technology are observed by two natives, Ray Wise and Pamela Adlon. And Ray Wise gets hurt badly and is beamed up to the Enterprise for life-saving treatment. Picard orders his short-term memory be wiped to prevent a breach of the Prime Directive, but we forget Vulcans are different people, and so that fails. Ray Wise gets beamed back to the planet, remembering the Picard. And
it's also the only mention of Catherine Pulaski through the entirety of the rest of Next Gen.
Which I'm glad they at least kind of mentioned her, right? Yes. Like, I was so afraid that they were just going to send her off into oblivion.
I thought it was weird that they mentioned her and not the fact that McCoy memory wiped everybody like every fourth episode.
That was 150 years ago.
It's like, oh, hey, we got some 60s astronaut in the transporter. I'll wipe his memory. I'll be right there.
So they find out that Ray Wise remembers Picard after being beamed back. So Riker and Deanna are beamed down to the planet, temporarily altered to resemble the Mintakans. And they go to look for there's a missing anthropologist from this explosion. So they go down to try to find him. Let's see. Ray Wise tells his tribe about his encounter with the Picard, and Deanna and Riker are notice that he's preaching the good word of Captain Picard, as one should, but they are like, rut-row, and they try to convince Ray Wise that it was all a dream and you guys are just crazy fundamentalists probably.
And he's not the least on all, Gabe.
It's not the least on all Geeb. This is Stilgar. This is a 1-to-1 for Dune 2. Okay.
Yep.
So the villagers find the missing anthropologist, and this only proves to them even further that there is an existence of a god named the Picard. So they come up with a solution to try to beam back the anthropologist while they are away from the rest of the group. So Deanna leads a group of an away team to go try to find another servant of Picard, and Riker is left alone with one of the other people of this community. Riker ties him up, takes Palmer to the desert, and is beamed up. But they are seen escaping and alerts the others. But Riker manages to beam him and Palmer back. But now Deanna is left alone amongst these people and want to offer Counselor Troy as a human sacrifice, as they believe that she might have angered the Picard.
She's not human.
And so naturally, human sacrifice.
She's a proto-Vulcan sacrifice.
Yeah. That's true.
That's the Joe and the Volcano episode of Star Trek.
One of the anthropologists that is back on the Enterprise says that Picard needs to make an appearance and give the Mintakans a set of commandments. Picard says, absolutely not. What about the Prime Directive? And this anthropologist is like, well, you already biffed it, so you might as well just go down there and fix it. And Picard learns which one of the people is kind of like the leader of the people and manages to beam her up aboard the Enterprise. He's able to convince her that he's not a god, just a normal guy. And Picard tries to explain the meaning of evolution and technology to her, and she understands when she is made to compare herself to a cave person. Down to the wire, Deanna is at the arrowhead end of a bow and arrow, right? And Picard loses one of the colleagues to internal injuries and shows the leader of the people that, hey, we can do a lot of things. We cannot bring people back from the dead. So Ray Wise is not lying to you. He just is incorrect in his assumptions.
Yeah.
And they both beam back down to save Deanna and help everyone understand that Picard is not a god. The guy with the bow and arrow wants Picard to bring back his wife from the dead. Picard says, I can't do that. Picard takes an arrow to the shoulder, nearly dies, and he bleeds. Does he not bleed just like the rest of us and proves he is not a god? All matters settled. The Enterprise dismantles the observation post and leaves. Once again, nary a consequence to be seen due to their actions.
This episode is it's one that makes you really analyze the Prime Directive.
Yeah.
And that's what I appreciated about this episode, is that it really makes you go, you know, we're just one slip up away from violating the Prime Directive if you're not careful, which is why I was questioning, why did we have an observation post on this planet? You're just flirting with disaster doing that.
And they don't even.
But you got to watch how the proto Vulcans evolve. You got to know.
And they don't learn, because I think that's the whole plot line of the third Next Gen movie is
Insurrection.
Yeah. Our anthropologists, this episode does have a notable thing. There's a couple areas in Los Angeles County, aside from Rearwise, a couple areas in Los Angeles County that get used a lot for outdoor scenes. One of them is a reservoir in like central LA. It's on top of the hill. Andy Griffith's show's opening was shot there. Quite a few episodes of original series were shot there. This was shot at Vasquez Rocks Nature Center, which if you remember the episode with the Gorn, I mean, literally you go a quarter mile down the road from where the proto Vulcans lived, and there's the rock where the Gorn and Kirk fought, you know.
Yep. So it's later used in JJ's Planet Vulcan.
You know, yep, it's JJ's Planet Vulcan, and of course Bill and Ted have a great showdown with their evil robot doppelgangers there. But it's one of those things, like, if you grew up down there, you've spent an afternoon there, or you've gone on a field trip there. So it's really kind of a trip when you're a Star Trek fan at 5, and you come around the corner and there's the rock where Kirk fought the Gorn, and you're losing your mind and getting in trouble with the teacher because you won't stop talking about Star Trek.
That was the one piece of trivia I had, Lee, so thank you.
Vasquez Rocks?
Yeah, oh, Vasquez man. Rocks.
I'm sorry.
That's okay.
I stole
Vasquez Rocks.
Now remember this episode. Remember this episode.
Why?
Because it will be used again later. It will be referenced later.
Ray Wise's character is the main villain in Star Trek Nemesis. He comes back with an armada.
I wish that would have made it good.
To kill the Picard.
All references that I understand.
Just put a pin in this one. All right.
Yeah. The last episode we're going to talk about, I was hoping for a happy, jaunty, good time episode, but instead we got the bonding. A startling surprise awaits the crew of the Enterprise when a mission costs the life of a crew member who left her son behind.
Thanks, what Ronald D. Moore.
What happens when you are orphaned on the Enterprise? So,
yeah.
Beaming down to the ruined planet of the Koinonans, I kept calling them the Oinonans. a race extinguished by civil war lasting several generations that led to self-destruction, and the Enterprise landing party loses in an explosion the life of crew archaeologist Lieutenant Marla Astor, who leaves behind a son, Jeremy Astor. Worf was leading the away party and says that the explosion was sudden and there was no warning. Astor took the full brunt of the explosion, and Worf is devastated. He was in charge, and this is what seems to be his first like real loss of life on an away mission where he was in charge. Picard delivers the news to Jeremy, who also lost his father to an infection 5 years ago, and Picard has always maintained that carrying children on starships is a very questionable policy.
Yes.
Working on
not
a starship
necessarily wrong.
It involves dangers and risks, and Jeremy was not involved in making that choice. Deanna counsels that Wesley understood, and in time so will Jeremy. Picard tells Jeremy that he's not alone.
No one's ever alone on the USS Enterprise.
Picard sends Geordi back down to figure out how she died. He finds the explosive devices that are triggered by a proximity alert. The proximity alerts are from the times of the Koinonen Wars, but these were recently dug out from the ground and left there to be found. But there are no life forms on the planet, so it's not clear who did this and why. Lieutenant Worf, in case you forgot, is a Klingon orphan raised by humans who commanded his mother's landing party, talks to Jeremy. His mother, meaning Jeremy. I just want Worf to be happy, you guys. Worf,
give him time.
Wants to perform the Klingon ritual of bonding with Jeremy, becoming his godfather in a way, because he feels so responsible. Jeremy, Deanna advises Worf to take it slowly, as Jeremy is still angry and that anger may get directed at Worf. Jeremy could also feel guilty about betraying the memory of his parents by reciprocating Worf's feelings of affection. Wesley, the crew member closest in age to the boy, still needs to consider how to share the experience of being orphaned. Wesley's not an orphan. He still has his mommy. Beverly encourages Wesley to share his feelings with Jeremy. Meanwhile, the Enterprise picks up a strong energy signature on the planet's surface. Deanna picks up a presence on the Enterprise, and Picard sounds a yellow alert. And suddenly, a woman appears, and it appears to be Jeremy's mother, Marla, coming
it is.
To
it's
take
her.
Him.
Yeah.
Kidding.
On the planet.
No.
Kidding. Look at our hidden cameras. They're right over there, ladies and gentlemen.
Mess with me like that.
There's a camera.
I'm fine.
There's
I'm just
a
fine.
Camera.
Let's go to the planet, Jeremy. Let's go. Let's go, Jeremy. Let's go to the planet.
Worf finds the woman in Jeremy's room and alerts Picard. The woman takes Jeremy to the transporter room. The woman disappears when Picard forcefully removes Jeremy from the woman. She reappears and she's able to recreate Jeremy's home on Earth in his room on the Enterprise and says that she can make him happy. Earlier, this is just for me, you guys. Earlier, Jeremy is watching a home video and he's playing with a cat, Captain Patches, who's a calico cat, and yes. He refers to the cat as a he. Calicos are nearly always female.
It's the future. Anyway. Genetic engineering. I don't know.
I mean, it is entirely possible.
You don't know that cat's pronouns, Rebecca.
That's
there
true.
Are that is true. There are male calico cats. It's rare, and it is the future, so genetic engineering could totally be a thing. I just wanted to put it out there to share my knowledge of cats.
No, you're right.
Deanna convinces Jeremy that neither his mother nor a safe home on the planet can be real. This time, Picard disconnects the woman's energy supply from the Enterprise and forces her to disappear. With her, the illusion vanishes, and Jeremy's room reverts to its normal form on the Enterprise, and Jeremy can see that it was all a fake. The ship is attacked, she appears again, and an energy form intrudes the Enterprise. The energy form takes the shape of Marla again, and again tries to take Jeremy to the surface of the planet. And again, Picard disables the transporters, and Picard is like, "Listen, lady, what's going on?
I know you're his real mom and all, but why are you in such a hurry?
Why are you in such a rush?" Speaking of cats.
He's here to speak for the cats, yeah.
Reveals that the planet was inhabited by two life forms, one of matter and one of energy. The matter ones were the Koinonens, who destroyed themselves, but the energy forms survived the wars. Since the boy's mother died on their planet, they feel responsible, and and they want to take care of the boy. Picard denies, and he tells the entity that while they can make Jeremy happy for a while, they can't provide him with a life with an education, a job, a career, a wife, and so on. The entity understands and leaves, and then Worf and Jeremy do the bonding ceremony, and I definitely wasn't crying and so happy for him. And then our friend Jake Black shared with me a page from a comic book in which Worf is talking to an older Jeremy who's at Starfleet and trying to encourage Jeremy to go out and like face his fears and explore. And
well, that was my next question, is I don't think we ever heard from Jeremy again, but I guess if it's in the comic book, then we did.
Yeah, there's I don't know which comic book it was. He just shared with me a page that showed Worf talking with Jeremy. And Jeremy was like, well, there's this girl I like, and I kind of want to abandon all of my hopes and dreams to just like kind of see if this girl likes me. And Worf had to be like, absolutely not.
She's not real, Jeremy. You fell for this before.
No woman you love is real. Yeah. You have to get over it.
Is she trying to take you to the planet?
Some trivia. Ronald D. Moore, baby. His original idea. Oh, no, we lost the Admiral.
He'll be back.
Ronald
it's
D. Moore's
Commodore charge. Oh, no.
Original idea was for Jeremy Astor to recreate his mother on the holodeck. Look, who's back?
Sorry,
back
I don't know again. What happened.
That's all right. Jeremy Astor was originally supposed to recreate his mother on the holodeck. However, Gene Roddenberry nixed the idea, believing in the 24th century, children would have a greater acceptance of death.
I don't know what point.
No. I'm sorry, Gene. No.
Just great thing. One of the great things in this episode that I liked was when Wesley finally goes to talk to Jeremy. And Picard's there, and he's like, yeah, I was angry at you.
No.
And Picard's like, wait, what? Why were you mad
to
at me?
Because
you're the one who came and told me my daddy was gone. It wasn't coming back. And Picard just has this look like, I'm stuck.
I don't. Oh, no. The kitchen's calling. I don't. This is also the debut of writer Ronald D. Moore, who later rose to stardom as the creator of the acclaimed reimagined Battlestar Galactica in 2004.
Yay. One of the greatest sci-fi shows ever.
So yeah, those are the first five episodes of season three. Personally, I started season three knowing that everybody was hyping it up so much, and personally I'm like, oh, this is it so far.
No,
huh?
It's not. No.
Okay.
It gets
no,
better.
It'll get better.
Sure.
This is their, you know, yeah, there's some missteps here for sure, but it definitely starts building. And it's funny because there's a lot of people have actually written about Michael Piller in particular. There's several books about how Michael Piller's process worked. And they're like, it didn't really hit its full stride until season four, but you can see the foundations of it in season three.
There are
episodes where you can definitely tell that in some cases he would bring so many writers in to polish a script that they couldn't legally give them credit. So they would ask the people that are actually already employed by the studio to step back and take a producer credit or something else, because they could only have like, I think, five writers credited at any given time.
This the bonding episode two also really, I mean, I can't speak to the rest of the season, but you know, starts to introduce emotions into our stories, right? Like, you know, this is the first time I really actually care about Worf and his feelings about something, right? And then not only Worf but also Wesley, like, yeah, we know Wesley's dad died and he's really sad about it, and he's kind of talked to Picard about it before, but now Wesley has an opportunity to use his experience to help other people, which we haven't really seen yet before,
right.
And it's nice to see, because it humanizes our characters, right? Like, it makes them more relatable instead of just these great space adventurers who are so cool and in space, but it actually, you know, gives them a little bit more depth, which I thought was really cool to see.
I think another thing you're going to start seeing, and I think you're going to love it, is that this new batch of writers that come in with season three, especially season four, they're Star Trek fans. They're not science fiction writers. That was the thing in the original series. This was Roddenberry reaching out to establish sci-fi writers and saying, come play in my sandbox. And they're like, okay, cool. I'm going to take this short story that was put in Amazing Adventures and I'm going to make that a Star Trek episode or whatever. And that just happened over and over and over again. And when the first couple of seasons of Next Gen came out, it was the same thing. It was established sci-fi writers and people that Roddenberry was comfortable with. Michael Piller was looking for fans of the project itself and saying, and they were almost to a letter. Everyone that he brought on were fans of Star Trek. So they're already familiar with the sandbox. They're not looking to adapt something they've already written. They want to write Star Trek. And you can start seeing it, especially as things start picking up steam.
Well, I certainly am so excited to see more. Any last words about these episodes that we've watched? Or
No.
Happy, always happy to see Ray Wise, you know?
Yeah.
like I said, remember the Picard and Wesley thing. Let's say put a pin in the Picard-Wesley thing because that's going to come up again in, I think, a season and a half or two seasons.
Okay. Until then, though, our next episodes that we will watch with our next episode, Booby Trap, The Enemy, The Price, Enemy. The Vengeance Factor, The Defector. We've got a string of episodes that are the blank, and that's... That starts with our next episode. But until then, we're going to keep going where no man has gone before, but a lot of people have gone before. Thanks, everybody.